We're going to get started. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Munjal Shah. I'm on the technology research team at UBS. We are very pleased to have IBM with us. From IBM, we have Rob Thomas, General Manager of Data and AI. Rob has been with IBM for roughly 20 years, and he's authored some books on big data and digital disruption. So instead of me talking about it, let's hear from the man himself. Rob, thank you for joining us.
All right, Munjal, thank you. Great to be here.
All right. To get us started, Rob, maybe you could give us some context on your background at IBM and maybe a little bit on your current area of focus.
Sure, absolutely. So I started with IBM in our consulting business, spent a few years there, and then moved to microelectronics. And at the time, we were creating a design services business in microelectronics. I ended up running that business in Asia for a couple years. And when I came back to the U.S. in around 2007, I joined, at the time, what was our data and analytics business. So now I've spent the last 10 years plus all in data. I did business development for a while, so some of our M&A, ran our product engineering, product development, some field operations, so all different areas in and around data. So today, I'm General Manager of Data and AI, which is all of IBM's software that touches on anything related to data movement, data integration, collecting data, on up the stack to things like data visualization, Watson, obviously, for AI. And I run everything that we have there today, meaning all of our go-to-market, product strategy, development, our support, field operations, everything in terms of working with clients.
Okay, that's a lot of responsibilities there. But you didn't mention Red Hat, but I do want to start with Red Hat because that also sort of would fall in the area. And clearly, within all of IBM, there's a lot of focus on Red Hat. Could you tell us a little bit about how Red Hat has helped frame IBM's overall hybrid cloud strategy? And in your view, when we look at the software stack, what does it mean to have the operating system with the Linux, you have Kubernetes containers with OpenShift, and then middleware and applications? So how all that ties in with the Red Hat operating system?
You know, what's interesting about the IT industry is a lot changes. It's technology. Obviously, things keep moving. There's also some things that don't change. And if you look at the last 50 years, call it, it's almost a sine curve of what I would call modulating between centralized architectures and decentralized architectures for IT. At the time that the mainframe first came into the world, it was very much a centralized architecture. Move all your data and applications to one place. And then we spent a number of years decentralizing. Things like client-server, mobile, the internet was all about decentralized architectures. Public cloud is actually going back to centralized architectures. The statement is, hey, move everything to this one public cloud. It becomes the centralized place for everything that you want to do. Our thesis is that IT ultimately wants to decentralize. And that's the thought process behind what we're doing with Red Hat. And the container platform is a view that architectures, IT wants to be open, and it wants to decentralize, meaning you shouldn't have to be locked into any one place. So let me decompose that a little bit more. With Red Hat, we've got the operating system. IBM obviously does a lot of work around microcode on processors. As you go up the stack, it's things like containers. And I'm not sure that's a commonly understood term yet, so let me talk a little bit about that. The best analogy for containers is actually shipping containers. So think about 1950s, 1960s. Everything for shipping goods around the world was custom. If I was going to ship this bottle, literally somebody would build a box for this bottle, put it on a truck, move it to a port. Everything was its own. Everything was unique. And I think it was 1968, ISO decides the standard around shipping containers. And that's what we see on the back of every semi-truck today. It's what you see in every port. It's how every port, the equipment as a port, is designed. It's what you see for every ship. And so that standard for shipping containers drove a massive amount of efficiency, which had second order effects like commerce. And that's exactly what we're doing with software now. So now bring it forward to software containers. What was done with shipping containers is what is happening with software now. Virtualization was great. Virtualization was largely focused on hardware. But as you move up the stack to things like the operating system, the data layer, the application layer, containers are about standardizing the deployment of that. And so that you can build your software once and it will run anywhere. And so today, if you're built on containers, something like Red Hat OpenShift, your apps and your data runs the same way on-premise as it does on IBM Cloud or AWS or Azure or Google Cloud anywhere. So it's really moving back to this idea of a decentralized architecture. You still get all the benefits of cloud, all the benefits of a public cloud, but you don't have to lock yourself into one cloud. And look at IBM today, we now have over 100 products that are containerized, and we've built some really interesting platform products that we'll talk about in a bit, Cloud Paks.
Okay. So that's a great analogy that you gave about shipping containers, because when it got standardized is when it took off, right, where you can make it easy. And Red Hat is a lot about open standards and open systems. How has that influenced or played into overall IBM strategy, and how have you or IBM been able to carry those open standard, open systems to your strategy for other product areas?
The IBM has a long history in open source. I would venture to say that Linux would not be where it was today if IBM hadn't endorsed it in the late 90s to where it became a viable alternative to Windows. And I'd say the rest speaks for itself in terms of the dominance of Linux today. And we continue to make investments in open source throughout the years. Another big one we did was in 2015, some work that I led where we built what we called the Spark Technology Center, which was our investment in an open source project called Spark. We built a technology center in San Francisco, basically committers and contributors to Spark. Today we have nearly 200 products in IBM that are built on Spark. And the impact of that is you get massive productivity out of your development, and it becomes a lot easier to integrate into a variety of different architectures, whether you're using something like Linux or Spark. So long commitment to open source that we've had, which will continue. Now, obviously, Red Hat continues that. And you look between IBM and Red Hat, the combination of us, more committers and contributors to open source than any other company in the world. You tack on the fact that we both have a big partnership with Cloudera. The three of us together, nobody can really touch what is going on in open source without us being incrementally, you know, instrumentally involved in that. So open source, I'll go back to what I said before. IT architectures want to decentralize. Clients want open architectures. So those two things are fundamental. To give you a client example, we've done a lot of work with ING, and they talked publicly about this not too long ago. And they operate in many countries. They have to be GDPR compliant. We help them build a data architecture that's using open source technologies, but then federating to what we'd call a global catalog of all their data assets. We can protect those and mask those. And that's because we've invested a lot in an open source project called Atlas, which is metadata management in open source. So my point in saying that is open source has been pretty fundamental to how we've been building products for a while. Obviously, Red Hat takes that and accelerates it dramatically.
Okay. So then in that case, as a combination, what has been the client feedback to the combination of IBM, Red Hat, not just open source, but more broadly as the two companies have come together? And in your role, how do you interact with the Red Hat team and how you bring that in to your area?
We're running Red Hat as an independent entity inside of IBM. So it's a different approach, and the early signs are very encouraging on that. To describe what that means, I prefer Red Hat. So as I'm building products, I optimize to the Red Hat stack. Red Hat does not prefer me, meaning I'm another partner to Red Hat. So that's how we actually operationalize it in the company. Now, we get great benefits of working side by side, whether it's in the open source community, or part of IBM. But it's critical because of Red Hat's role as kind of the open standard, if you will, across what's happening in technology. We want to let that continue as it is because they've been very successful in that model. Why am I encouraged? I'll give you some signs of things. Just take our events. I run a lot of events around the world, and the event attendance is up 300% for all the events I do, from Korea to the Middle East to here in the US in the last 9 months. So we have clearly sparked, I'd say, a huge amount of curiosity about what's happening, how do we bring IBM middleware and solutions, combine that with Red Hat. That to me is a pretty good proxy that there's a lot of interest out there.
Shifting gears a little bit, data and databases is also an area that you focus a lot. Now, the broader move to cloud has had some impact on traditional databases. So could you talk to that a little bit, and then how has the traditional databases evolved or changed to address customer requirements? And second question, but to follow up, but related, what do you think about cloud-based databases, and what type of customers are likely to go into a cloud-based database?
Sure. So let me decompose the market a little bit. The database market globally is $45 billion, roughly. It's growing double-digit. Subset of that is data warehousing, which is $18 to $20 billion, growing double-digit as well. And then a subset of that would be what I call NoSQL databases, which is about a $3 billion market. That's growing faster than the two bigger ones. So the world of databases has evolved dramatically in the last decade, from just databases to data warehouses to things like NoSQL databases. So there's all these different flavors out there. Our approach and the way that we've kind of built our products is we think clients are going to have a need for all these different variants. Very few want to have to manage all those different variants. So we partner with companies like Cloudera for Hadoop. So we can provide databases, data warehouses. We partner with Cloudera for Hadoop. We partner with MongoDB for document databases. Partnered with EnterpriseDB for Postgres. We want to be the provider of what I would describe as a fluid data layer for all of your data needs across a hybrid cloud environment, meaning you're gonna have databases on-premise and some in the cloud. The key thing will be how do you stitch those together to get them to operate as a single environment. That's our strategy. To your question on what moves, it really depends on the workload, the application, where's the application running. It's pretty rare that if you've decided I've containerized my application, it's going to run on my private cloud. It's unlikely you're going to move that data store to be on public cloud because you want your apps and your AI close to your data. Things like very high performance data warehouse environments, like what we build with DB2 for operational analytics or Netezza, the way that we run that, the economics for those are really good in a private cloud environment. And so it just depends on the workload and the environment. The key point is data environments are going to be very fragmented. We think we can play a unique role as an integrator in bringing those together.
But when you say you partner with the Cloudera, MongoDB, you provide a layer on top of it, or you provide a layer at the bottom of how do you partner with them? I was just curious.
So actually both. I would say the strategic wedge is something that we call a federated SQL engine, where if you write a query, not to get too technical, but if you write a query, we can find the data, whether it's in Hadoop or Mongo or Netezza or DB2 or anywhere. So it's a way to bring all your applications to kind of one query environment. So we partner at that layer. And we distribute their products as part of this integrated layer. Clients get a lot of value out of that. Below that would be through things like how we monetize on object storage, on IBM Public Cloud, things like our Spectrum storage for managing large compute clusters. So we actually partner on both ends of that. But I'd say the value for the client to start with is typically, how do I integrate all these pieces to get them to act like a single data fabric?
Okay. We talked a little bit about cloud. I mean, we just touched on Cloud Paks. I mean, you announced Cloud Paks this summer. And from what I understand, these are IBM solutions that are containerized in a way that clients can use them. Could you give us a little bit more detail? I mean, that's a very simple statement, but maybe you can help us a little bit about what Cloud Paks are. And where do clients find value in them?
Okay. Cloud Paks are taking IBM middleware and new development and saying, we're going to do all of that in a containerized architecture, which means they deploy as microservices. So you don't have to install everything. You kind of choose the pieces you want, much like you would in a public cloud environment, and optimized and run exclusively on Red Hat OpenShift. So it's capabilities of IBM software exclusively built on OpenShift. One of the value drivers is basically you get common logging, monitoring, and management across those Cloud Paks. So it starts to become really easy to deploy and run those environments because it's all using the same standard, all built on OpenShift. Today we have six Cloud Paks. We've got Cloud Pak for data, Cloud Pak for automation, which is basically RPA, business process management, Cloud Pak for applications, modernizing apps, Cloud Pak for multi-cloud management, so managing multiple cloud environments, Cloud Pak for integration, which is messaging and connectivity between apps, and then Cloud Pak for security. So we've got six today. Just to give you a sense for how these deploy, I think one really good example is Sprint, the big telco here in the US. We've worked a lot with on Cloud Pak for data. The problem they wanted to solve was aftermarket service. How do they better deploy materials, technicians to support aftermarket scenarios? Like most companies, they've got data in a bunch of different repositories, sometimes hundreds. And so they install Cloud Pak for data, which virtualizes data from all those different repositories. And they have one place where they can build their AI models to do optimization around servicing of parts and servicing of deploying staff. So they're able to take AI models, build and train them in one place, federating data from a bunch of different sources, and they've gotten tremendous outcomes in terms of efficiency. They couldn't do that without a container platform, which is OpenShift. They could not do that without a set of containerized data and AI services, which is what you get with Cloud Pak for data. And it's a good example of how, and this happened in 3 months. Traditional deployment, you would take 3 months just getting stuff installed. So it's really changed the rate and pace, the economics of doing something like this. We've got examples like CVS, Aetna, who we're working with on modernizing their apps. That's Cloud Pak for applications. Hertz, which is using it for messaging. They're using Cloud Pak for integration. And so we're starting to see major progress here in terms of adoption.
Okay. Well, let's shift a little bit to data and AI. And that's your area. With the proliferation of data over the last several years, what do you think is the linkage between the business of data and AI in the enterprise?
I like to say there's no AI without IA, meaning information architecture. I'd say this is one of our biggest findings in the last couple of years is your AI is only as good as your ability to understand your data. And by information architecture, I mean kind of all the things we talked about from where you're storing data to how you understand your data. There was an MIT study at the beginning of last year that said 80% of AI projects fail because of the lack of data or the lack of understanding of data or just not even being able to find data. So to me, the linkage between data and AI is fundamental. We built this concept we call the AI ladder, which then I published in a book. And the AI ladder is basically what are all the steps, or think of them as rungs of a ladder that a client has to go through to collect their data, organize their data, analyze their data, then ultimately start to infuse models into their business processes. And what we found is companies are at different levels of maturity. Some have done a lot of data collection. They do that really well. Some haven't even started on data organization, but they realize, you know, they start to realize they need to. So people are at different levels of maturity. The whole point of that model is to give them really kind of a methodology, if you will, or a guideline to start to talk about it in their organization. CEOs get infatuated with this AI shiny object, and sometimes you have to temper that and say, look, let's get the data in the right form. That way our AI can scale at an even bigger level.
So let's drill a little bit more into AI. In terms of, in your perspective, how does IBM play in the AI space, specifically with the Watson capabilities? And what do you think you need to win in enterprise AI?
So first, let's talk about what Watson is, because I think sometimes there's a misunderstanding on this. It's not a black box. We can actually decompose it. So I want to spend a minute on that. So I wrote a series of blog posts about 30 days ago called This is Watson, which was really demystifying this so people could understand the componentries. So first is Watson is a set of tools if you want to build your own AI. So think of it, we've got a hammer, we've got a screwdriver, we've got a tape measure, we've got all the tools that you would need to build your own AI. Now, the tools of AI are not a hammer and a screwdriver. It's things like a studio environment for building models and training models. It's a runtime, so that's machine learning, where you deploy your models. And then you need a capability to manage the life cycle of your models. Where did the data come from? How did you make those decisions? Is there bias in your model? Those are the tooling of Watson. And many of these are available for download on the web, so anybody can go and try them. Things like Watson Studio, Watson Machine Learning, Watson OpenScale. So it's a toolbox. I think one great client example that's relatively new is Harley-Davidson. A company in Milwaukee, we wouldn't really think of Harley as an AI company, but they saw some of the capabilities that we have around automation, making a data scientist job a lot easier. And now they're using Watson Studio, machine learning to build models to predict new potential customers of Harley-Davidson. So number one is a set of tools. Number two is it's a set of applications. So when we've seen a repeatable problem, we've packaged that up into an application so that a line of business can consume Watson. That's things like Watson Assistant, which is automating customer service, customer care. It's things like Watson Discovery for automating data discovery, understanding all of your data attributes. It's things like planning analytics with Watson, so embedded as a capability. So these are horizontal and vertical applications, obviously Watson Health, different applications. So you got tools, you got applications, and third is Watson as an embedded capability. We have many software partners who pick up a piece of Watson, embed it into their application to make it better at the core mission of what they're trying to do. So Watson takes three forms. Most of it's available on the internet for anybody to pick up and try. We look at things like customer satisfaction, which has been tremendous. I also look at public references. We have more than three times the number of public references of any AI competitor out there, which to me is a really good sign that clients are adopting it, clients like it, and they like it enough that they're willing to talk publicly about it, which is great.
So that's a great point. I mean, like, if you think about it, there's so many tools. I mean, IBM obviously on the forefront of it. Others have made these tools. And if you look at AI, the potential, just if you read anything in the news, it seems like there's so much potential with AI. Why do you think the adoption is still low despite the potential that AI could provide? And where do you see the most interesting applications for your clients with AI?
This is, I'd say, a bit of a mystery, but hopefully I'll give you my point of view on it at least. The McKinsey study just a few months ago said AI will add $16 trillion to GDP between now and 2030. So it's the largest economic opportunity any of us will ever see in our lives. Yet, if you look at adoption, recent Gartner surveys say enterprise adoption of AI is somewhere between 4 to 10%. So it's still relatively muted. And why is that? So I think it's for three reasons. First of all, it's data. We talked a good bit about that. If your data is not in an accessible form, it's not modernized with containers, it's not clean and usable, that can be an inhibitor. And that's why a lot of projects we see, clients get excited about AI and then it turns into a data project, but that's okay. because we do both. So data is one reason. Next one is skills. There's a big shortage of data science skills. And anytime you have a shortage in the market, there's two ways to deal with that. One is you can augment it with people. Luckily, we have a great services organization that's got a lot of data science skills. You can also automate things. So like the Harley example I gave, they're using Auto AI, which is the capability we built for automating the data science process. So you got to solve the data problem. You have to solve the skills problem. Last is trust. Certainly in regulated industries, the question becomes, do you know how your AI is making decisions? Can we trust the AI to make decisions? There's things like SR 11.7 in financial services around model risk management. You have to be able to explain not only how the model made decisions, but where did the data come from? Who accessed the data? How did they use the data? So trust also can become an inhibitor. So we formulated our product strategy on really addressing those inhibitors. We have to nail data. We can automate through to solve the skills problem. And then trust is a key capability in Watson for how you would manage a life cycle, not just of models built with Watson, but models built in open source or any AI tool for that matter. Now, to your question on how does this, you know, what are the applications? The big ones in my mind that I've seen are customer service that I mentioned. You can just automate interacting with customers. That's a huge lever for clients. A good example, that's Royal Bank of Scotland. In a year, they're now automating 40% of their customer inquiries using Watson. And then they took their staff that used to do that and they put them on the hardest problems, so their customer sat's gone up 20 points. It's a great example of an application of AI that's augmenting the workforce. So I think that's a great example. So you got customer service, supply chain, procurement, HR, finance. I'd say those are the big five, call them workflows or business processes, where AI will play a big role in the future.
But then to do AI, I mean, we talked about data a little bit in AI. We all agree to some point that data has gravity. And you've announced Watson Anywhere over the last year. Are you seeing any change in where, or where do you think AI is being deployed more? Is it more on-prem or is it more on cloud? And do you see anything changing in terms of pace of deployment, whether it's in the cloud or on-prem?
People are gonna deploy AI largely where their data is, would be my observation. And for a long time, we had kept Watson focused in the IBM cloud. And as we did more and more customer engagements, we realized what I just said was the absolute truth, which is, A, you have to bring your AI to the data, not the other way around. We announced Watson Anywhere in February because we saw the opportunity to make Watson more accessible for on-premise private cloud environments, as well as any public cloud. We basically want our AI to be wherever the data is, public or private. Just doing that alone has accelerated the use of AI, because you take away this big inhibitor of, if step one to your project is move data, that's gonna slow the project down, because, you know, UBS is a big bank. Any big bank, there's probably like 20 approvals you need to move data, because it's just the nature, and that's true for any big organization. And so just by breaking down that barrier, you can see adoption start to take off. I'll give you another example. WPP, or the subsidiary Wunderman, we started working with them, and they just don't want to do public cloud. They say, look, we've built a database with 250 million customer records over the last 30 years. That database is in our private cloud. Like, that's where we want to do it. If we had not announced Watson Anywhere, they would not be a big Watson user today. But they are, just because we made it accessible, made it easy for them to go use. And so I think you'll start to see adoption continue to take off as we get over these, you know, kind of the different challenges that I talked about. But we're really encouraged about the outcomes that we see clients getting.
So ultimately it could be any, depending on where the data is.
I think it will be wherever the data is. You can even think in the world of 5G as you extend to edge. 5G is really about data supremacy. And that means you're gonna wanna start doing your analytics on an edge device or your AI on an edge device. You don't necessarily want to say, step one, bring all the data back to a central place. So AI is going to happen where the data is, and that could be anywhere in a 5G world.
So if we look at IBM's solutions with Watson and the tools that you mentioned, so is it fair to say that most of your business related to AI is software, or is there a lot of services pull in, or do you do a lot of, does AI pull in a lot of services for IBM?
So let's talk broadly for a second. So when we talk about a hybrid cloud, because that's kind of the undercurrent to everything we've talked about, we see that as a $1.2 trillion opportunity. And half of that is services. So whether it's consulting to actually help a client deliver a project, or it's management, like what we do from an outsourcing perspective. So half of that $1.2 trillion opportunity is services, basically just helping clients build, run, manage, modernize, whether it's their applications or their data. About $400 billion of that $1.2 trillion is software, specifically, which is clients will be modernizing existing estates, applications, and data platforms for containers, for hybrid cloud. So services, and then the rest is infrastructure, which kind of gets to the whole IBM business model, because as you can see, all those things fit together. The more you're adopting AI, the more you typically need services, the more typically you're gonna need infrastructure for things like GPU acceleration, or different types of optimization. And so it really covers all of those. As you look at AI, the tools available for data science teams are really easy to use. But then why is there a big services opportunity? It gets back to the data piece. Well, you have to find the data, get it in the right form. That creates a huge services opportunity. You think about the different workflows I talked about, from customer support to procurement. There's a lot of change management that has to take place in every organization to do that. That's a classical consulting opportunity for how do we define a new strategy around this change management business process work. So it's across all three of those vectors.
But from a tool perspective, it's more AI and more software, and then the processes work is more on the services.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, all right. I think we have time for one more question. Just we'll end it on a strategic note. And looking ahead, what do you think are the biggest challenges in the data and AI space over the next several years?
I like to think of them as opportunities, not challenges. So the one of the biggest opportunities I see is for IT itself. And we haven't talked much about this yet, but we think we can automate the role of a CIO. And if you think about what a CIO, not chief information officer, not investment officer, in terms of running technology, we can do a lot with AI to automate what they do in terms of understanding incidents, proactively addressing problems before they become problems, compliance, code vulnerability. So I'm really intrigued by the opportunity around using AI to make IT better, because that will make every company run more efficiently, will make employee onboarding easier. You can think of all the different second order effects of that. So we have some stuff we're working on that we'll talk about in the future, but I think that's a huge opportunity. As part of building products for IBM, the other hat I wear is working with our research organization. And you cannot be competitive in AI without having a robust research investment, because the world's moving too fast. And so some things that I think about that we're, you know, looking at the future are things like homomorphic encryption, which is basically, so today if you have encrypted data, if you're gonna do analytics or AI, the first thing you have to do is decrypt that data. Homomorphic encryption says we can start doing AI or analytics on encrypted data, which is hugely valuable when you're dealing with sensitive data sets or working across multiple clouds. So we have things like that going on in research. We've got something called analog AI, which is about how do you bring compute and memory closer together. There's a classic computer science problem called von Neumann's bottleneck, which basically says even if you have a very powerful CPU, you're always limited by how fast you can get data out of memory. So we're looking at things like how we use neural nets to combine CPU and memory in the same silicon. That will be very interesting as we think about adoption of AI in the future. So a lot of different opportunities going out there. I would just say the research piece is really critical to us because you can't keep up for what's going to be coming next unless you're making a significant investment in research. And a number of the things I talked about, whether it was auto AI, like that came directly from IBM Research and we put it into the product. So it's part of the advantage I have being in IBM.
Okay. All right. That's all. We're almost out of time. Thanks a lot, Rob. Really want to thank you for being here and having this discussion with us.
All right. Thank you, Munjal. Thank you.